loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee released an unusual and partisan report yesterday, concluding that there was no collusion between the Russian government and either the Trump or Clinton campaigns. Significantly, the report, however, perpetuates the narrative that the Russians launched cyber attacks against American institutions. Again, no actual hard proof of this assertion has been offered. The report said that several Trump campaign officials had made poor decisions, but that no crimes were committed. Next, British Prime Minister Theresa May said yesterday that Sergei Skripal, a former Russian double agent for the British, who was poisoned last week along with his daughter, was likely the victim of a Russian assassination attempt. The Russian government is demanding proof, and the high-stakes international mystery is deepening. Then students across America will walk out of schools tomorrow in a nationwide protest against gun violence. The National School Walkout is both a memorial to those killed by guns and a protest of government inaction. And then Education Secretary Betsy DeVos on Sunday gave what many observers are calling a train wreck of an interview to the news program 60 Minutes. DeVos struggled to answer basic questions about the nation's schools and failed to defend President Trump's school safety ideas. And finally, a Saudi general may have been tortured to death and several businessmen abused while in captivity at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh during Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's crackdown on powerful figures in that country. The Crown Prince has systematically arrested, purged, or exiled virtually anybody who could pose a threat to him. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to an alleged poisoning in the UK. British Prime Minister Theresa May said yesterday that Sergei Skripal, a former Russian double agent for the British who was poisoned last week along with his daughter, was likely the victim of a Russian assassination attempt. The Russian government is demanding proof, and the high-stakes international mystery is deepening. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. George, welcome back.
I wish I could say I'm happy to be back, but it's very depressing times here in London that I have to share with you guys.
And tell our listeners what exactly or how exactly this is playing out in the UK. This is so confusing. Brian and I sat with our producers today for more than a half an hour just talking about the details of this case, the what ifs, who benefits, who loses. And we're no farther along in our thinking, I think, than we were hours ago.
But let me just ask you before, George, before you start, I'm looking at the Business Insider headline, which I think is really captures the dominant theme in the media here. And the headline goes like that. It reads this: Putin wants everyone to know it's him with brazen nerve agent attack in the UK, experts say. Now, that's unusual given the fact that Putin is just about to the elections are upon us in Russia. Anyway, what's your take on all of this?
Well, I personally think this will go down with the Zinoviev letter, with the Gulf of Tonkin incident, as one of the great hoaxes with the most serious repercussions, implications in all history. The fact that the Russian president is facing re-election, even more pertinently that the world is headed for Moscow and Russia in the summertime for the World Cup, which Russia is hosting. The fact that these two people were clearly of no consequence, if the Russian state wanted to kill them, they could have killed them entirely inexpensively and at any time. One of them, the daughter, actually lives in Moscow. So if they wanted her dead, she could have been murdered in an alley with her own scarf at no cost at all. And the other, the father, could have been murdered in prison when he was a prisoner as a traitor to the Russian Federation. Got a very light sentence, by the way, which seems to suggest they didn't take him all that seriously even back then. The fact that in broad daylight, in public, this mastermind capable of rigging the American elections, rigging Brexit, rigging the Catalan independence struggle, and God knows what else, was stupid enough to attack with a nerve agent invented by Russia with Russia's signature on it. In my opinion, you'd have to be crazy to believe that. But a large number of people, certainly in the media, and even more depressingly in the parliament, who behaved yesterday after they received the prime minister's statement as if Iraq had never happened, as if the Chilcot inquiry had never happened, as if intelligence briefings given by a prime minister should be treated as if they were carved in stone and just brought down from Mount Sinai. It's deja vu all over again, as they say in the comic sketches. It is like going back to the rush to war with Iraq. And the only person in the entire parliament who tried to stand up against this was the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn. And he was barracked, heckled, rubbished, mainly by his own side, by the remaining Tony Blair supporters. He's being assailed as unpatriotic, as a Putin stooge, and so on. It is profoundly dispiriting that journalists by the score, by the hundred, virtually without exception, are accepting at face value that Russia would do such a self-harming thing, such a self-disfiguring thing, for no purpose that anyone has even yet speculated upon. And that's before we go into the very peculiar circumstances of the attack themselves, which you may not have time to hear me adumbrate.
Go ahead. We're speaking with George Galloway from the UK about the poisoning of a British, a Russian who was a British double agent who had been in Russian prisons, received a 13-year sentence, was released after serving only 4 years, has lived in the UK for many years, considered probably to be a very low-level figure. Otherwise, he'd still be in a Russian jail. He could have certainly been killed in Russia. His daughter could have been killed in Russia where she lives. But no, the argument maintained by the U.S. mainstream media and by the British media is that the Russian government decided to use a nerve agent produced in Russia with a Russian signature to try to, not to kill them, but to try to kill them on a public park bench out in broad daylight. Go ahead with your story about the peculiar circumstances.
You've summed it up quite well. Just some additional points. This agent, of course, invented in Russia, like the Kalashnikov, is, of course, widely available now in all countries. The mystery deepens when I tell you that Britain's own nerve agent chemical warfare base is just 7 miles away. It's called Porton Down, and it's 7 miles away from the scene of the crime. Secondly, this agent was present inside the house of the British agent Skripal. We know that because a British police officer is gravely ill as a result of being exposed to it in the house. Yet the doctor who treated the couple on the park bench for fully half an hour, including mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, has had no ill effects whatsoever. We're told that this nerve agent is many times more powerful than sarin or VX, and yet it failed to kill two entirely unprotected targets. It was not present in the restaurant where they ate, in the pub where they drank, but it clearly is present in the bodies, not yet bodies, of the two people most affected. It's present in the police office, police officer's blood, and it's also present in the house. So it's a big mystery what this agent is, how it managed not to kill them, how it managed to affect the police officer, but not the paramedical staff who treated them at the scene of the crime. These are all very big and unexplained mysteries. And if I just give you a hypothesis, it's only a hypothesis. I'm not saying it's true. But it would be entirely possible that the agent the chemical agent, the nerve agent, was being kept in the house of Skripal. And it was somehow released and affected the couple and the police officer, all three of whom became gravely ill. They're critically ill, but stable in the ensuing hours. But that, too, is a mystery, because this agent is supposed to act within seconds. That's what it says on the tin. That's how they sell it, that within seconds, it will wipe you out completely. And yet it didn't wipe any of the people affected out. And some of the people who got closest to the victims are unaffected entirely.
And let's talk about what this does, too, before I go on to another question for George. It leads to chronic weakness in the arms, a toxic hepatitis that gives rise to cirrhosis of the liver, epilepsy, spells of severe depression, and inability to read or concentrate. And when it was first noted, one of the scientists who was developing it was accidentally exposed to it. He never recovered from the exposure and died 5 years later after this deteriorating health. George, we have a couple of minutes left. Brian and I were talking before the show about how to conduct an investigation. The first thing that an investigator would ask is, who has the means, the motive, and the opportunity to do something like this? Now, you've raised a good point. This may have been an accident. It may have been in the man's home. We don't know. We don't know, and the investigators aren't telling us. Let's assume that it was not in his home. Who would have the means, the motive, and the opportunity to carry something like this out?
Well, there's a fourth question, John. Cui bono is the ancient question asked in investigation of crimes.
Who's the beneficiary?
Yes.
Who's the beneficiary of this crime? Of all the possible beneficiaries, the Russian state must, on any logical appreciation, be the least benefiting from this crime. They have plunged the international system into crisis. Theresa May is about to announce a series of retaliatory measures, which may be, at this stage, almost unimaginably condign. They may include the closing of RT in Britain. They may include the almost unprecedented expulsion of the Russian ambassador. They may include England being pulled out of the World Cup, and many, many other serious consequences. So clearly, Russia is not the beneficiary of this crime. And yet, we're asked to believe that this evil genius, this Indian wizard, Vladimir Putin, he's so clever, he can do all these things, but he's so stupid that he would do this. Now, anybody with access to this weapon, that could be any state, it could be any terrorist group given the material by a state, it could be an accident, it could be any number of things. But before even investigating all of these things, Russia has been found guilty, given an arrogant ultimatum that no Russian leader, let alone Vladimir Putin, could possibly accept. The ultimatum was, are you guilty or are you guilty? And you've got 36 hours to answer. Well, I'm sure that the Russians will treat that with the contempt that it deserves. And so we're now about to plunge into a very, very cold war indeed that might just get hot.
This is going to be a dangerous period. I'm sorry that we're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. We'll come back to this issue in the coming days. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee released an unusual and partisan report yesterday, concluding that there was no collusion between the Russian government and either the Trump or Clinton campaigns. Significantly, the report, however, perpetuates the narrative that the Russians launched cyber attacks against American institutions. Again, no actual hard proof of this assertion has been offered. The report said that several Trump campaign officials had made poor decisions, but that no crimes were committed. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Jim, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Jim, the intelligence committees were supposed to be the last bastion of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. I think this kind of proves that there's been a breakdown even there. But still, this Republican report, once you really look at it, doesn't seem to be too terribly different from what the Democrats are saying. The difference might be with the use of that word collusion, but they both seem to be pointing the finger at Russia without having offered us any evidence yet. What do you think?
Yes, I think, in fact, it's an example. This one-page summary they put out today, which I've read, is an example of bad bipartisanship. I was very surprised at it because their position is, I quote, concurrence with the intelligence community's assessment's judgment, except with respect to Putin's supposed preference for candidate Trump. So the Russians did all these nasty things that that intelligence community assessment by Obama intelligence community said they did, all these nefarious things, except for the fact that nobody in that Putin wasn't preferring Trump. So they have really reinforced this notion that there's a Russian threat, that the intelligence community assessment is to be taken as proof, factual proof of a Russian threat. And in fact, they're just trying to say, but Trump had nothing to do with it. You know, and this had nothing to do with Trump. And I want to go back and emphasize that in that intelligence community assessment, this is the language in there. Judgments are not intended to imply that we have proof that shows something to be a fact. Assessments are based on collective information, which is often incomplete or fragmentary, as well as logic, argumentation, and precedence. So that very assessment says, don't take this to be a fact. This is our judgment. And yet this is being presented by Republicans and Democrats as flat fact, that the Russians did all kinds of nefarious things. The only issue that they're disagreeing about is whether Trump was directly involved in that or not.
You know, there's one thing, too, in this one-page summary that has really piqued my interest. There's a section here called initial findings, and it has 7 bullet points of initial findings. It says that the draft report contains 40 plus initial findings, but these are the main 7 points. The last one of the 7 is problematic contacts between senior intelligence community officials and the media. I note a blog that appeared yesterday, Sarah A. Carter, taking back the story, in which she says definitively that what they're talking about in that point is former Director of National Intelligence Jim Clapper, who has been a thorn in the side of this administration, leaked classified information related to the investigation to Jake Tapper of CNN. I'm wondering, do you think that this is just a shot across the bow, or do you think this is to prepare us for another one of these Justice Department espionage investigations, this time after an A-list political name?
I very much doubt there'll be serious Justice Department investigations of that. I think it's just the Republicans are going to continue saying that the sourcing of all of this was very bad, that there was a campaign by Obama administration and or anti-Trump people in general to get nasty information out about Trump, and they went to the media. And, you know, theoretically and I guess technically, legally, they could be pursued for this. Clapper himself went out and said, oh, these leaks are terrible. We should investigate them.
He sure did.
The leak that he did, apparently, that he's now accused of doing. But this is all par for the course. And again, if you really start to pursue legally all these things that go on all the time in Washington, influence peddling, leaking to the media, I mean, there's going to be no end to this. And so I doubt that they're going to pursue that, you know, thoroughly. And they're just going to throw it out there to say the waters were muddy and to muddy the waters further.
Let me ask you, too, about the conclusion. Jim, it says here the draft report will be provided to the committee minority, the Democrats, on March 13th for review and comment. After adoption, it'll be submitted for a declassification review, and then the declassified version will be released to the public. Why didn't the Democrats sign on to this in the first place?
I really don't know. Well, just the only reason I can think of is because they say, oh, everything is true except for they didn't care about Trump. The Russians didn't care about Trump, and there was no collusion between Trump. The Democrats, the point of disagreement here now between the Republicans and Democrats, note, is how directly was Trump either being pushed by the Russians, favored by the Russians, and or colluding with the Russians. And the Democrats want to keep that open, and they're going to disagree with the Republicans about that. But what we're seeing here is there's not going to be any serious disagreement about the innuendo that Russia has been trying to destroy American democracy and American elections. So, you know, that's the point of disagreement that they're going to agree to disagree on.
If the Russians thought that Donald Trump would be better than Hillary Clinton, and there's, you know, maybe some people, I know some people in Russia would, because they were afraid Hillary Clinton and the neocons were pursuing a very confrontational approach to the Russians in Ukraine and elsewhere. But you know what? So are the Republicans. This is bipartisan. It's always been bipartisan. Even in the Ukraine coup in February 2014, you had Hillary Clinton's Victoria Nuland out in this square at Maidan urging the protesters, who were, some of whom eventually carried out an armed coup d'etat against the democratically elected government, corrupt but democratically elected. She was cheering them on, but so was John McCain. I mean, it was bipartisan. The defense budget is bipartisan. Support for the military-industrial complex is bipartisan. And what we have now is Donald Trump. He's sent advanced weaponry to Ukraine, anti-tow missiles. The big parts of Syria are now under the control of the U.S. military under Donald Trump's direction. New sanctions, really strong sanctions against Russia. If Russia thought Donald Trump was going to be their guy or nicer or better, that would have been a bad play. But again, John, I think it's important because all of the facts have been thrown out the window during the past 18 months. The facts seem not to matter. The facts don't really yet prove that there was any Russian hacking. Like, even though we're a Sputnik station, we're loud and clear, we are independent politically, you and I are both independent politically, if there's evidence of it, we want to talk about it. But actually, right now, there's no evidence. There's evidence that some troll factory in St. Petersburg, maybe, which not necessarily linked to the Russian government, bought Facebook ads, but those weren't Facebook ads supporting Donald Trump either.
No,
and 56% of them came after the election.
That's why I've concluded for myself personally that there's literally nothing new in this report. Nothing. It's the same allegations. It's the same take our word for it analysis.
And guilt by association. It's
Jim, precisely.
Jim, it's, you know, during the witch hunt of the 1940s and early 50s, if somebody signed a petition for a peace group, and some of the people on the other, some other signers in the peace group were communists or affiliated with the World Peace Council, then they'd lose their jobs and everybody kind of stopped signing petitions. Everybody went along with the witch hunt because they didn't want to be a witch or they didn't want to get punished. To me, this report, while it says no collusion between Trump and the Russians, I think you're right. The big takeaway here is not really about that issue. It's really about building a consensus for ongoing enduring animus against Russia, again, without hard evidence.
I think that's exactly right. It's funny because my father, who was a lawyer and very conservative, always used to say to me, and all of us, I'm the youngest of seven kids, used to say, don't sign anything for that very reason.
I came from that same generation. People were told, don't sign petitions.
I was going to say, you know, also this business of the investigation. I mean, they did not get the servers. The FBI didn't take them. They refused to even ask to talk to people who claimed to have firsthand knowledge of the hacking. Craig Murray, Julian Assange, Kim.com, who all claimed to know who did it and have met the person, but they don't even talk to them. So it's not even a real investigation in that sense. You know, this is a political thing to maintain the Russophobia and the aggression against Russia and to have a food fight and an argument about whether Trump was involved or not. There may indeed have been Russians who thought, as you say, Trump was going to be better because he said things that indicated he might. But that's for gosh sake. I mean, look at Nikki Haley yesterday about Syria. We're going to attack Syria again. So, you know, he's not that, and everybody knows he's not that.
If there was a hack and it was from a foreign power, why the heck would the FBI have not have taken custody of that DNC server to carry out a forensic investigation. And James Comey said under questioning before Congress, oh, yeah, it would have been better. Okay, that's not like optional if this is a national security threat.
Yes, it's war against the United States, but we just forgot to do that.
Some of the people in Congress say maybe we should respond with nuclear attacks to cyber attacks, but let's not get hold of this server to do a forensic investigation first.
Issue a subpoena for Craig Murray, who says he'll talk, a British ambassador, or issue a subpoena for Julian Assange, even if he doesn't talk to you. He'll talk to you via Skype.
We're out of time. We've been joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Students across America will walk out of schools tomorrow in a nationwide protest against gun violence. The National School Walkout is both a memorial to those killed by guns and a protest. We're joined from Chicago by Kofi Adamola. He's an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Kofi, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you all for having me.
So this National School Walkout actually has taken on a life of its own to the point where, and I'm just going to use this anecdote as an example, a close friend of mine whose daughter just applied to college received an email from the college saying, Wednesday is the National School Walkout. We want you to know that if you walk out and you're suspended, we will not hold it against you because we support your right to protest. I think that's dramatic. And it looks like, if the mainstream media is to be believed, it looks like thousands of students from across the country will walk out of school tomorrow. What are you hearing in Chicago?
Well, in Chicago, we've been organizing exactly around that. We've heard two different things. Broadly, the CEO of CPS Chicago Public Schools has announced that there will be no consequences for students should they walk out. On the other end, there are some individual schools that have decided to enact consequences such as suspensions towards students. So it's really subjective on schools or whether or not they're going to support the walkouts or not.
Right. I'm looking at a piece in the Chicago Tribune that appeared this morning saying that high school students all across the state of Illinois will walk out at 10 a.m. tomorrow. And this is specifically because the government has not taken any action so far. And it's been a month since the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting in Parkland, Florida. What do you think that students can accomplish with this walkout?
Well, it's interesting. I like that you say that it's taking on a life of its own, because that's exactly it. You have the one dominant narrative, which is supporting the Parkland students, trying to fight for gun reform, and this new resurgence of student activism and civic engagement, which is beautiful and which is powerful. It's affected gun legislation being expedited here in Illinois. And unfortunately, we saw the tragedy with Florida, with the government essentially rejecting any real reform that was heartbreaking for the Parkland students, right? But the other narrative is here in Chicago, students have connected with students from Baltimore because they have a similar narrative as far as being biased by mainstream America, but also they're dealing with poverty, and the communal gun violence, and the extremities of being in low-income, poor Black communities. So they found their voice because they've been, you know, asking for resources, asking for gun reform, and demanding those things way before Parkland happened. But now, hopefully, they'll have a platform where they can say that the way we're policed, the way we deal with gun reform, the way resources are allocated to communities are completely different from what we experience. Parkland did a beautiful thing with supporting the Stonewall students by giving them access to 145 therapists. They had access to 40 dogs for emotional trauma support healing. That's a beautiful thing. However, in Baltimore and Chicago, we don't have those wraparound support services. Young people have police in their schools and metal detectors in their schools. And if they're lucky, they have access to one counselor at most. That is very problematic. So we're saying we want equity, or the young people are saying they want equity. They want access to mental health care, trauma, jobs, things that will help systemically to reduce and prevent gun violence.
Yeah, I think that's critically important issue, John, because obviously parkland and the horrific nature of it captured the imagination of people and got a lot of support from all kinds of different sectors. Lots of money mm-hmm. flowed in.
Mm-hmm.
There's routine violence that people, young people are experiencing in schools, particularly in urban areas. And the resources aren't there. The support's not there. The media attention is not there. It's considered routine. And as a consequence, there's kind of a not just an insensitivity, but sort of a blocking of the reality of what black and brown communities in particular are facing. And without the demand for equity, if we just put this as an abstraction about guns or gun controls or background checks and not realize that it's also about support and it's about demilitarization. Trump's calling for arming teachers. In many schools, there's metal detectors. There's all kinds of rules and militarization that goes on inside schools. It doesn't actually prevent violence. It just makes young people more liable to be prosecuted or policed by the police. In other words, victimized once again. Is that how you see it, Kofi?
That's absolutely how I see it. We already are fighting back against the prison, the schools to prison pipeline. And again, young black and brown people are already overly policed, not only in their communities, but then at school. And when schools already are structured to function and operate like a prison, you're just setting them up for more failure and reinforcing more negative consequences, which, again, plays into their already traumatic experiences and their mental health care. So they're actually exasperating the problem by trying to militarize schools more. And arming teachers is beyond ridiculous and asinine. But unfortunately, that's sort of where this Trump regime is kind of heading towards. And we all saw it coming, right, because of the neo-fascism that he represents. But he's also sort of veggie backing off of what was already being processed in places like Alabama, where they were already looking to do that. So that legislation was kind of already out there on the state level. Now we're just seeing it being wrestled with on a national level.
I can't imagine, Brian, the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association rolling over for this lunacy of arming teachers. I know a lot of teachers. My parents were both public school teachers, and I can't imagine any teacher that I know agreeing to do something like this. As Kofi points out, this is insane. It's neo-fascism, and we haven't even begun yet to see teachers putting their foot down collectively and saying, absolutely not. There may be pockets in places like Alabama, which is fascist anyway, or Mississippi or whatever. But I can't imagine teachers across the country in general agreeing to this lunacy.
And the other thing, and we'll take it back to you, Kofi, is that after the Columbine shooting, there was the mass introduction of armed police officers schools. I mean, that became a thing. And metal detectors in the schools. School safety officers became armed to the teeth. In many cases, replaced with regular police officers. And urban districts in particular paid the highest price as the number of arrests of children skyrocketed. I mean, that's where this leads. I mean, this is actually not the solution.
That's it. They're there to arrest and harass children. They're not there to protect them. They can try to convince the American people that they're there to protect them. But that's just not the case.
And we saw in Parkland, the police who first arrived, including one who was stationed there, actually stayed outside because, you know, which I consider to be an act of extreme cowardice. If you're there and there's an active shooter, you're supposed to go in. You're supposed to engage. Anyway, Kofi, go ahead. Talk to us more about Chicago.
I think you all named it perfectly. Chicago has been experiencing militarization of schools since the 90s. So this isn't a new trend, pre or post Columbine for urban communities. So I just think it's very powerful that students from Baltimore and students from Chicago have gotten together and they've created a coalition. They're calling themselves Good Kids, Mad City after the Kendrick Lamar album. And their hashtag is Be More Shy. And we're hoping to amplify their school walkouts tomorrow. Some of the collective are students from the Englewood schools that were recently closed. Some of the collective are students from the West Side and North Lawndale who have recently lost loved ones to gun violence, like a family that I work with lost Tony Webb, who was killed one day before his 18th birthday last week, Tuesday. So this is very personal. This hits home for a lot of us. We have all been affected by gun violence, either directly or indirectly, or by proximity. So it makes absolute sense that young people are demanding that they have mental health care, that they have trauma-informed schools, that they have restorative justice in schools, that they have jobs and equity and community revitalization. These are not outrageous demands. These are common sense demands. And I really hope that people hear those. And I hope that politicians and everyone else that's benefiting and profiting off of their pain and incarceration can turn the tide, because if not, we're going to see, you know, more legislation like they got passed last year here, where mandatory minimums were raised to 7 years for a young person that has a gun. Not a young person that shot someone, but a young person just possessing a gun, more than likely because they are in fear of being a victim themselves. They now do a mandatory minimum of 7 years. They're also trying to push out legislation right now in Illinois, further criminalizing young people that may have or may have not known that they were in a stolen car. They're going to get an automatic felon for being in that car, and they lose all kind of rights, in the sense that it's guilty before proven innocent, meaning that they can't argue that they didn't know that they were in the stolen car. So where's their legal defense? How is a defense attorney supposed to combat that when the assumption from the bill is that guilty, you just assume guilty upon contact with the police? So we want to roll back these so-called tough on crime bills, and we really want to support bills that foster restorative justice and community revitalization. And that's what these Baltimore and Chicago students are fighting for.
John Coffey is completely right about this. You can't look at gun violence simply from the point of view of guns or availability or access to guns.
That's right.
There has to be a holistic approach, and taking into account and maybe making as the top priority the underlying social, the dominant social issues that are really, really get to the heart of the matter.
That's right. We're out of time, but I want to say something very quickly as a practical matter for our listeners in the Washington, D.C. area. Prince George's County, Montgomery County schools in Maryland, Arlington County, and Alexandria City in Virginia are all participating in this walkout.
As the District of Columbia has made it clear, they sent out a notice to parents, I think either last night or this morning, saying any student who leaves will be given an excused leave,
yes,
if they want to participate in the workout.
Same thing in Fairfax County, which is the largest county in the area. They're not actively participating, but if students elect to walk out, they're free to do that. We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Chicago by Coffey Adamola. He's an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear, and we'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos on Sunday gave what many observers are calling a train wreck of an interview to the news program 60 Minutes. DeVos struggled to answer basic questions about the nation's schools, and she failed to defend President Trump's school safety ideas. We're joined from Chicago by Bill Ayers. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. Bill, welcome back. It's been a while.
It's good to hear your voices. Nice to be here.
It's our pleasure. So what do you make of Betsy DeVos? You know, so many of us have said from the very beginning that she is was and is not qualified. She doesn't know what she's doing.
And she's an enemy of public education.
She's clearly an enemy of public education. She's in over her head. Can she survive this much longer before she does even more damage to public education?
Well, I'm not sure. What she did in Michigan was certainly destructive, and the lasting effects of her role as a funder and a billionaire ideologue in Michigan was devastating, and now she's bringing that program to the nation. Can she last? I have no idea. She only got there because of her money and because of her ideology. She hates public education, and she has her whole career. She wants to make a Christian, private Christian educational system, and that was her purpose in Michigan. But the thing you're saying about her incompetence is obviously true. And then you go back and you say, well, the Democratic Party, going back 30 years, had competent people like Arne Duncan and John King, but they also bought into the very dangerous idea that education is a commodity, is something to be bought and sold at the market, as opposed to either a public trust or a human right. And so for 30 years, we've been dealing with a devastating bipartisan approach to dismantling public education in favor of charters, or in Betsy DeVos's case, religious schools and vouchers. But I think it's important to say that the Democrats aren't going to be able to mount the kind of opposition we need because they've been in collusion for too long. But yes, she is terrible. Her interview was striking and telling on so many levels.
Bill, let's help people understand, because there's so much. Well, the whole partisan lineup is also laced with a lot of, well, just bias. People who are Democrats think, well, the Democrats are better than the Republicans because guess what? They're not the Republicans. Or Hillary Clinton was better because she wasn't Donald Trump. And there's kind of a superficiality about politics in America, you know, sort of mainstream politics. And people lose a sense of how much the two parties actually are working in tandem. You can see it in the defense budget. Interestingly, you can see it in these attacks on public education over the past decades. Even though there's a misnomer that it's really just a Republican program. And as you mentioned, Arne Duncan, Obama's choice, also from Chicago, while not as extreme as Betsy DeVos, certainly in the same, going down the same track in terms of minimizing or harming public education. What's the reason that the Democratic Party is not defending public education?
Well, I hope, first of all, I would say it's not unanimous. I think that there are pockets, but I think the important thing you're pointing to is that on the important issues of the day, whether it's defense or economics or economic policy or foreign policy or educational policy, there's a bipartisan agreement. And that agreement, and when it comes to education, is terribly, terribly dangerous. And it will lead to the end of public education. I wouldn't, however, say that there are no differences between people. I think there are differences. The important thing is to be sophisticated enough to know that on the big issues of the direction, for example, of defense policy and educational policy, there's agreement at the bottom line, and we have to oppose that. In other words, if we're going to build a kind of popular movement to defend public education, and frankly, it's well underway. I mean, these guys have had the big megaphone. I mean, the Democrats and the Republicans, they've had the big megaphone, the major media, the foundations, the corporations, both political parties for 30 years, and they have not won the moral argument about why we should get rid of public education. And the resistance, both from parents around movements like Opt Out, as well as from teachers' unions, progressive teachers' unions, like Chicago, like what we just witnessed in West Virginia, are saying no. We are not going to give up on the ideal of public education. It's never been fully realized, and we need to fight for it, but we can't say, oh, well, the answer to the problems in public education is to privatize the whole thing, which is what DeVos wants. The other thing I think we should point to right away is that in her interview on 60 Minutes, and this goes right along with the Trump administration, with other things she has done, she is a clear white supremacist. She cannot separate herself from the idea that that everything is about individual kids, and that she doesn't want to look at things like the overrepresentation of black kids in expulsion rates or in detention rates. She doesn't want to look at that because she's all about the individual. But that's a lie of monstrous proportions, and it perpetuates a white supremacist school system, which we need to oppose.
I think that's exactly right. And you know, one of the things that struck me too is that in this 60 Minutes interview, she said that she believed she was misunderstood. I think exactly the opposite is true. I think that people don't like her. People really revile her because they understand fully what she stands for. She stands for the end of public education.
Absolutely. She wants to destroy public education. That's been her mission for two decades. And the thing is, people saw, both here and in her confirmation hearing, that she has two things going for her. She's a billionaire with an open checkbook to the far right. She's got a charming smile, and she is as dumb as a brick. She absolutely doesn't know a thing about public education or educational policy or what good teaching is or what curriculum is. She doesn't know about, you know, the rights of disabled people and so on and so on. It's a travesty. And yet it fits perfectly in with the Trump administration, where you put somebody who wants to destroy the environment in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency, somebody who knows nothing about foreign policy in charge of foreign policy. I mean, this is the Trump administration writ large. I think in Betsy DeVos, you see a very transparent picture of what that looks like.
And especially people who are Christians or evangelicals. I'm talking about working class people or middle class, lower middle class people who are being duped by these religious right-wing people. They're not going to help their kids. And in fact, they're pursuing an ideological agenda. And just for our audience who may not know that who Betsy DeVos's brother is, it's Eric Prince, none other
right.
than Eric Prince. I mean,
the founder of Blackwater.
Yeah, and still a very prominent Republican, another billionaire who gets his clout from money. But Eric Prince is also being implicated in the whole Russian, the whole question of whether there was collusion, this and that. So, yeah, it's a dynasty. But this is also not atypical. The Trump administration is an administration based on familial ties and kind of endorsing the princelings. And the DeVos's and the Eric Prince's are part of that kind of dynastic way of ruling.
And Prince, just again, for people who might not know, because even though it's not ancient history, it might seem so because things happen so fast and people have a short memory, or they weren't born back then, but Blackwater was the mercenary army used by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld to carry out the vicious occupation and mass murders of Iraqi civilians and others in Iraq during the time that began March 19, 2003 with the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Exactly, and it's changed its name, but not its mission. So that all continues. But back to DeVos for 1 minute. I mean, the other thing to note is that, you know, I was impressed that Leslie Stahl actually had the courage to ask her hard questions, because so often the media rolls over. And Stahl had a couple things that she was absolutely right about. She, for example, said, if you see a failing school on the south side of Chicago, why wouldn't you invest money in improving it? Why would you take money away? And she smiled that big billion-dollar smile and said, well, it's all about individual kids. It's not about systems. Well, that's just nonsense. I mean, the fraud of the charter school movement and the fraud of these vouchers is the idea that somehow something will be improved if you say, okay, I'm going to attach a few thousand dollars to each kid, and wherever they want to move, that's fine, because there's no such thing as a system. It's all individual kids. Well, anyone who's worked in a school or knows anything about schools knows that actually the entire gestalt, the entire, you know, network of what makes a school run includes counselors and curriculum and well-trained teachers who are staying, who are stable. And it includes arts and, you know, athletics and many, many things. You can't simply put a dollar sign on a kid and let him roam around without doing serious churning damage to a public educational system. And that's what happened in Michigan. The other thing she did in that interview, incidentally, just so people know, is she outright lied. She said, the evidence is, the research says that in Michigan, since the charter schools, schools have improved. And it's exactly the opposite. There is no credible evidence that the churning of a system like Detroit or like Chicago or like New Orleans results in anything good. It goes the opposite direction. And we've seen it again and again. But somehow, again, in the Trump era, evidence and facts don't matter. But we have to insist that, yes, they do.
I think that's exactly right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Bill Ayers. Bill is an activist, an educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Saudi general may have been tortured to death and several businessmen abused while in captivity at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh during Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's crackdown on powerful figures in that country. The Crown Prince has systematically arrested, purged, or exiled virtually anybody who could pose a threat to him. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ali, this is new news here in the United States, but it's not necessarily new elsewhere. Tell us what you've heard.
Well, when the Saudi Crown Prince arrested dozens of people, among them his cousins, who he wanted to clip their wings and take away any financial capacity that they have, so they do not pose a danger or a risk or a challenge to him and his absolute rule. Among those who were detained is a general by the name of Ali Al-Ghahtani, who was an assistant to the son of King Abdullah, and that son fled, maybe with the help of Ali Al-Ghahtani, and he's now reportedly in France. And Mr. Al-Ghahtani was tortured and died in the process. And torture in Saudi Arabia is actually legal, for those who are wondering. It is legal to torture people in Saudi Arabia, and there are two methods of torture or two tracks of torture. We're not talking about, there is one that they call corporal punishment, where people are flogged, and that's torture by itself, but also torture in terms not only during interrogation, but we have cases of people, just yesterday, a man who was arrested just because he was passing by, he was arrested and he died. A few months ago, a young man died in the same process. So over the past few years, mostly Shia prisoners have died in torture, although some of them have been in detention for many years. So Ali Al-Ghahtani's death was not a surprise, because it's part of the Saudi regime policy to torture people, even if they were arrested for criminal activities, because torture is the norm.
You know, let's talk about the Ghahtani family. When I was serving in Saudi Arabia, I met many members of this family. It's a very honorable family. It's a family that has served the country for generations, going back to the founding of Saudi Arabia. The Ghahtanis are known to be honest, hardworking people. So what happens now in relations between the Al Saud and the Ghahtanis? Certainly the Ghahtanis have to object to this prominent, important, well-known member of their family being tortured to death for no reason.
Ghahtan is the name of a very large tribe, mostly in Yemen. In the Arabs, there is the Arab mythology that there are two main Arab tribes, Ghahtan and Adnan. So this is not a family. It's a large tribe, and a lot of people have carried that name, including those who are assistant to Mohammed bin Salman. One of his main advisors is Saud al-Ghahtani. So it's highly unlikely that you would see a reaction and tribal reaction, but you might see his immediate family and relatives, of course, being upset with his death, and they will have grumblings about it. This is really a very hard question to answer, because in terms of, when you have really a country of fear or a kingdom of fear, it's very hard to predict what people will do. And many people are too scared even to talk about it. Typically, in some areas where torture victims are handed to their families make sure to take pictures of their bodies to show the torture that their family were subjected to. But in this case, we haven't seen that. So it shows you that not only the government scared them into not doing it, but maybe they are also scared by themselves not to document it, to publicize the reasons that this man was killed.
Let's talk about some of these other people that have been pushed aside. And I'm thinking especially right now of the former Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef. We said on this program the last time you were on that Muhammad bin Nayef was another highly respected figure in the kingdom. He had been the head of the intelligence service. He had been a longtime partner of the American government on counterterrorism. In fact, he was given the CIA's highest honor for his work on counterterrorism. And the next thing we know, he's under arrest. He's been deposed and no one has any idea where he is. What are you hearing about Muhammad bin Nayef and some of the people that were around Muhammad bin Nayef that have been pushed aside in Saudi Arabia?
Muhammad bin Nayef was the American choice to become the next king.
He was indeed.
He was supported 100% by the Obama administration. And he was, like you said, he was given the George Tenet Medal, which is the highest in the CIA. He was a CIA guy. He was the CIA man in Saudi Arabia, setting up all these bases and getting CIA help even against protesters. For example, Qatif, CIA operatives worked and provided used drones to basically give information and take pictures of the protest. So this shows you that you cannot really rely on the United States to secure your back. If somebody can come and provide more service or offer a better deal for the Americans, you will be sold out. And Muhammad bin Nayef now, he has nothing. The only thing he has is his home or one of his homes. The rest were taken. He doesn't have access to any bank account. The man controls hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe a billion dollars or more. So he's lost everything, power, people around him. He doesn't have anybody who was with him. His children cannot travel. And he is confined to his home, and sometimes he's let out, but under guard. Mohammed bin Salman has basically ended the political life of Muhammad bin Nayef. Having said that, today's announcement by President Trump to put Pompeo as the Secretary of State might give Muhammad bin Nayef some hope that he will be back in action. You never know what will happen, in the next year or so, if the United States government decides to shift again its direction in Saudi Arabia.
Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is coming to the United States, and it's expected widely that he'll receive the red carpet treatment here from President Trump. Why is he coming to this country? What do you think that he and the administration are going to be discussing?
They will discuss a few things. Of course, every Saudi leader have received the red carpet because the Saudi regime exists because of the United States. So they must always extend that special treatment to them. From the Bush administration, which had a very special relationship with King Abdullah, and to Obama, to Trump. It's not going to change. There is no American president who is going to destroy or damage the relationship with the Saudi monarchy. That's never going to happen. But the reason they're here, like I said before, Mohammed bin Salman is, before he becomes and announces he's king, he is doing this visit. This is his final job interview, as if we may say. So this is the time. He went to the UK, and he's coming to the United States and offering even more gifts so he can be crowned as the next king of Saudi Arabia. And that will happen. It's not going to take months. I predict 2018, this is the year that Mohammed bin Salman, maybe by the summer, July or August, he would become the new king of Saudi Arabia, even if his father is still alive.
Well, that certainly is the conventional wisdom. I would not be at all surprised, Ali, if Mohammed bin Salman is king by the end of the year, maybe even by the end of the summer. And I agree with you that this is a job interview for him. We are out of time. We were joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.